This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Thank you, Shannon. Dr. Kirk Heinze is co-hosting with me today. And our first guest is MSU alumnus and NPR national political correspondent, Don Gagne. Don, welcome. And what is your MSU pedigree?
Right. I grew up in Monroe, Michigan. I went to Monroe Catholic Central High School and came to MSU and was there in the late 70s. When I talk to people in Washington or around the country, and they ask when I was there, I tell them Magic Johnson was one of my roommates, which I tell my kids that too. they stopped believing it a few years ago. but anyway, I was there at a pretty great era for Spartan sports. And football, we were dealing with some probation, as people may recall. So we couldn't go to the Rose Bowl. But it was that Kirk Gibson and Eddie Smith team. Basketball, of course, it was Magic Johnson and that whole crew. And then we had some pretty good baseball teams in there too. Again, Kirk Gibson being the guy who most people think of.
Yeah, Don, you may remember Gibby wasn't allowed to play baseball for the first 3 years, and finally his senior year they gave him a shot, and the rest is history.
Oh, I didn't realize there was any kind of a rule or restriction. Was it because of his football scholarship? Was that it?
They wanted him to concentrate on football, and it was Daryl Rogers at the time, and he just wouldn't let Littweiler and Rogers used to argue about it, and then finally he relented.
Well, I remember a game where Rick Leach was playing for Michigan, and Gibson, of course, was playing for us. I don't know if it was at this game or not, but I used to live in Mayo Hall, so it was right around the corner, a two-minute walk from Cobes Field. And it was just a fabulous way to spend an afternoon. And I remember Gibson just launching balls out of that ballpark and out to the Red Cedar. It was pretty fabulous.
Don, you're also a lifelong Tigers fan. How did you sort of get bit by that?
Oh, I think it's just a question of growing up at the right time in Michigan, in my case, Southeast Michigan. But I think my first game ever at Tiger Stadium probably would have been like the 1966 season. Could have even been 1965. But I remember my dad coming home from work, telling me some guy he'd worked with had offered him a couple of tickets. So we went, and we actually sat that day in seats that became my favorite seats forever at Tiger Stadium, and I used to try to get them all the time. We were in upper deck boxes, right above first base. And people who remember Tiger Stadium remember how close to the action you were in those seats. So we were probably 7-8 rows up from the rail in the upper deck. But it felt like you could just reach down and touch Norm Cash playing first base. And there was a guy playing for the Kansas City Athletics that day whose name was Reggie Jackson. So I had a pretty memorable first trip to the ballpark. And needless to say, it stuck.
You know, Don, even though it's March Madness, being a Tiger fan is music to my ears. You never forget that first time at Tiger Stadium. You're walking up those ramps, and all of a sudden you come out and out of the aisle, and you look down, and all of a sudden there's this thing that looks like, I can only compare it to like Oz, with all that greenery and everything. I mean, it's like, wow.
That's just the perfect description of it, and I've used that very description to people before, and it's such a cliche to kind of talk about those old urban stadiums, and you come out of the city and there'd be this this big expanse of green grass, but especially if it were a night game in Detroit, boy, it was just lit up, and it was Technicolor. And in those early days, I think it also helped that the old wooden seats were also green. And people refer to these old ballparks as green cathedrals, and I don't know that there was another one grander or shall I say more sacred than the old ballpark at the corner down there.
And Don Gagne, one of your most listened to pieces was that one when Tiger Stadium closed too, but the 2013 bunch plays at Comerica Park, and everybody sort of has them penciled into the ALCS with the Angels. Would you be surprised if that doesn't happen? And what do you, how do you assess the 2013 bunch?
Well, let's say all signs point to a good year. We've got some question marks in the bullpen, specifically who's going to be our closer, right? But we've got an amazing starting lineup, starting rotation, you know, four or five deep, you know, anchored by Verlander, who wouldn't kill to have him on their team. And then with this lineup with Victor Martinez back this year, it feels like even without a closer, we could let in 9 or 10 runs a game and still win most of them with this lineup. Now, that said, the beauty of baseball is that you got to play the games, right? And we all know it's a game that breaks your heart. So I take a deep breath. I have very high hopes, and, we'll see what happens come October. But I feel pretty good about this team, and it sure has been fun to watch this current era of Tiger baseball, where they are competitive year in and year out, and you just know it. Know they're going to be there.
You know, Don, speaking of breaking your heart, I was at Game 4 last year down at Comerica, had the opportunity to watch the San Francisco Giants jumping around on our pitching mound. That was a heartbreaking experience. But what do you think about the infield, the fielding? We've got issues with the closer. Our infield isn't any stronger than it was last year fielding-wise.
Yeah, no, that is another issue too. And, while Cabrera impressed me and a lot of people with his ability to make the move over to third base last year, especially after taking that ball off his cheekbone or eye socket or whatever it was, during spring training, it's still Brooks Robinson over there. I guess the infield is one of those things that you kind of they look a little slow and they look somebody said it's the major league's only 1,000-pound infield. I don't know, is it? And that's not counting the catcher, obviously, right? That's certainly an issue too. But again, I think we're gonna put up a lot of runs, and I did spend a few years kind of longing for the return of Placido Polanco, because he was just, you know, such a solid guy at second base, and he hit the ball too. I see he's now playing for the Marlins this year. Not that we should have grabbed him. I think Placido, as much as I love him, is nearing the end probably, but certainly that's a question. And so you talk about having a ticket to, or watching Game 4. I had a ticket to Game 5.
And ouch.
And it was of course it was a presidential election year last year. So I was running around Wisconsin chasing the political story, all the while trying to figure out how I could catch a flight from either Milwaukee or O'Hare into Detroit in time to see Game 5. And about the time I got everything worked out, Game 4 rolled around, and I got to relax and go back to political reporting.
<right. laughs> NPR's Don Gagne with us. Don, a couple of the names that might have an impact this year, too. Torii Hunter is new, and I almost feel like Victor Martinez is new. It's been so long since he played, but both talk, you hear a lot about what character guys they both are. What will they bring, do you think?
Yeah, and I sound like such a homer when I talk about this team, but I don't have to be objective when it comes to baseball, right? I can just cheer for my guys. From what I hear, Torii Hunter is, you know, a guy who fits right in the clubhouse. He's a likable guy, and I also hear that even though he's deep into his 30s, what is he, 37, 38 years old, something like that? I'm not even sure how old he is. I'm told by people who've been watching him and seeing him in the locker room and on the field that he seems like he's in his 20s. So maybe he's just one of those guys who is blessed with perpetual youth. Let's hope he's got another year or two of it. And I think he'll be a good fit in Detroit. And it's going to be fun to have him in the outfield. And then Victor, we barely got to see him. So you're right. It does feel like he's new. He can hit the ball. And just the notion of having you know, Victor and Fielder. I almost called him Cecil, but Prince Fielder and Cabrera, all kind of in the middle of the lineup, has to be a very scary thing for the opposition. So
no doubt,
it's going to be fun to watch. Fingers crossed.
That's right. Don, I want to bring in a mutual friend who wants to kind of tell the audience a little bit about you and something he's got in mind related to you. Our old buddy Gary Reed, who runs all of WKAR, is here and wants to say hello.
Okay, so I've been close to Gary almost as long as I've been a Tiger fan. when I was, I think it was my first year at State, I had a class called Broadcasting 201, or maybe it was Radio Production 201. Gary probably remembers better than I do. So that's, he was like my first great professor at Michigan State, and we have kept in touch. So anyway, hi, Gary.
Well, Don, I have to tell you that it's a thrill to have you on the station here, and it was just stunning for me to be able to sit back here for a few minutes and listen to not only the preeminent political reporter in the country, but apparently now the preeminent sports commentator. I don't know if you knew this, but the reason we're on today is because we're trying to replace Earl Robinson. So in case that NPR thing doesn't work out, my friend, you got a gig back here.
every time I get back to campus, I keep thinking, oh, if only I could I could cover Washington and live here. That would be fabulous.
Well, I have to tell you that that could certainly be something that we would work on. So, but in all seriousness, Don, I have to tell everybody that with WKAR at Michigan State here, we came into the College of Communication Arts and Sciences coming up on about 2 years ago. And one thing that we do every year in May at the graduation is honor some of the outstanding alums that come from the college. And Don had the distinction of getting a outstanding alumni award from the College of Communication Arts and Sciences some years back. And with WKAR coming on board, we looked through and we said, you know, we need an award as well for someone who really personifies what public media is all about. And within about 2.5 seconds, Don Gagne's name came to mind. And so for the first time ever, our inaugural WKAR Media Master Award will be given to Don Gagne and will be presented this May at our MSU graduation. And Don, I can't think of a better candidate, a better person to receive it. The fact that you're an alum is just icing on the cake. But when WKAR thinks about the importance of what we do here, for broadcasting, for our public, for the communities that we serve, I can't really imagine anybody who would be better suited to pick up this award. And so I'm very, very pleased to announce here publicly for the first time that Don Gagne will receive the inaugural WKAR Media Master Award.
Congratulations, Don.
That's great, Don.
Well, it's I have to admit I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm really I'm honored. Obviously, I am humbled, and I'm just really touched because I mean, Michigan State has meant so much to me over the years. You know, I plan on going there probably from the time I was 8 or 9 years old, and it was everything I could have imagined it could have been for me, both as a student and as a person. And WKAR is where I discovered public radio, and it's where I first, I think it's way back when WKAR used to, like, early in the morning used to play nature sound effects, and I would in the morning, and I would set my alarm and wake up to that
rings
and
a bell.
To that, and then the news would come on, and this is when I was a kid living in the dormitory, and Gary, I mean, you may recall conversations we've had over the years, but back then I did not plan on a career in radio. I did not plan on a career in public broadcasting. I actually have degrees in both broadcasting, or RTV we used to call it, or telecommunications, and I have a degree in advertising. But pretty early on in my career, I kind of fell into a job and found my way into public broadcasting, even though I'd been a fan for many years, and it was just such a perfect fit. And now geez, I've passed the 25-year mark in public broadcasting and still counting. I hope I've got another 25 more, but it's really been a special place to work, and it's doubly special that it all started for me at Michigan State. And it really is a very special thing for you guys to single me out like this. Thank you.
Well, you're very, very welcome. It's our pleasure, and we're going to look forward to seeing you here in a couple of months. And I wouldn't be surprised if you don't make another guest appearance on one or several of our shows.
I think co-hosting this sports show when you're here is imperative. And, you know, Don, as Tony Kornheiser would say on PTI, we'll get you out of here on this one. We've appreciated all your time, and I know we could have a 3-day conference on this, but. You know, how has doing what you do changed over the years? Obviously, the technology has played such a big role, but how different is doing your job? The thing you mentioned to me about Twitter being almost your personal news feed that frees you up from looking at so much other stuff, and kind of where is it going? And based on that, what do you tell these kids that want to do what you do?
You know, I always tell kids to just kind of be ready to ride the wave. I mean, journalism is journalism, and storytelling is storytelling. And the thing that hasn't changed, and I do like to stress this, is that, you know, a good story is a good story is a good story. And we have a public that is just hungry, starving for well-told stories and for information that they, you know, base daily decisions on. And public broadcasting certainly plays a huge role in that. And our audience numbers, show that. But the way we tell those stories and the tools we use and even the medium that one works in has changed. I do still think of myself as a radio guy, and I always will be a radio guy at heart. But am I a radio guy when I'm on Twitter? I don't know. I think I'm just a reporter on Twitter. And am I a radio guy when I'm blogging at NPR.org? I guess I am, but I'm something else as well. And certainly, you know, we've gone from cassettes to reel to reels to mini disc machines to digital flash recorders to splicing tape, which is something Gary taught me to do way back when.
Me too.
You know, to digital editing, where you can always hit undo, which is a magical thing to be able to do. but all those tools have just been things that have helped us do our jobs easier and maybe do a little more reporting before deadline, because we've got a little more time, because these things let us work a little bit faster. But I tell students, just kind of get your foot in the door somewhere. Don't think, you know, this is what I want to be, so that's what my first job has to be. And then once you get your foot in the door or your foot in the stream, then you can kind of start swimming and adapt and kind of find your way and work your way to the things that work well for you. But the technology is going to continue to change, and we don't know what this business is going to look like in 10 years. We don't know what it's going to look like in 5 years. But if you're somebody who wants to inform people and wants to witness history firsthand and have a job that's never dull, this is a good place to be.
Well, Don, well said. Hear, hear. Thank you again for joining us. Congratulations on the award from Gary. We'll look forward to seeing you in May, and people can keep up with you on Twitter simply at Don Gagne. So thanks again for joining us, and go Tigers.
All right. Go Tigers, go Spartans, and there are plenty of sports tweets mixed in with my political coverage tweets.
That's right, and go green, too.
And go green, that's right.
Thanks a lot, Don.
Thanks, Don. Thanks,
Don. See you later.
Take care.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Gary Reed's still with us, and we're going to bring in another friend, Scott Meyer, who's from sort of the commercial side of the whole radio business. Scott, welcome.
Is it okay to say that here?
I
started out in public radio when I first went to college, and was fired, actually, from the public station.
Uh-oh.
Because they said you could either work here or work in commercial radio, and I had a commercial job to help pay tuition. And I kept my commercial job, and he said, "You're going to be the first guy we've ever fired."
Uh-oh. Well, you know, I'd like the both of you to kind of reflect on what Don said, because you guys are radio veterans, too. I'd like to ask the same thing, kind of.
Does
where
he mean
are
we're old, Gary? Is that
no, I am.
Radio
too,
veterans?
No. Yeah. Where is it going? Gary, how about you first?
Well, I think Don makes a great point in terms of the technology. From my standpoint, the technology, it's always going to be something. It's always going to be there. We're in the content business. I don't really care whether this signal is going out to our transmitter or it's going out the pipe to the internet or however else it comes up in the future. You know, I want to be in the content business. And Scott, I wouldn't have fired you, actually.
I appreciate that.
I have to say.
Because, but I went to Wisconsin, so forgive me.
Well, But the reason I'm saying that is that I think we have a different role. Mm-hmm. And for a public broadcaster to assume that our listeners only listen to us, or for a commercial broadcaster to assume that their listeners only listen to their piece, is just really narrow-minded. I know that it's not the case. And so the way that I look at what we're doing broadcasting around here is to concentrate on content. We can do things in the public broadcast world that are just not economically viable. And many of my closest friends are commercial broadcasters, and I get that. So I look at us as being in the broadcasting business. We serve different niches. We serve different populations. And I know that our audiences listen to both of us back and forth based on the content that's there.
Content is king, you said years ago. Were the first one I heard say that. Scott Meyer, your reflections.
Well, the biggest changes have been really started in 1996 with the advent of being able to own more than an AM and an FM in any one market. And with consolidation, what happened is just like the housing bubble, you ended up with a broadcast bubble. You had a lot of companies that went out and made themselves bigger quickly, and Wall Street got involved, and a lot of money was exchanged. And at the end of the day, you've got a lot of companies that are gone now, and many companies like my own that still has a litany of stations they paid a lot of money for back in the go-go days when all this was going on. And what it's done is it's really created the ultimate consolidation, which is doing a lot more with a lot fewer people. So in that respect, it really has changed the business. There's a reason that guys on the commercial side probably die 20 years younger than guys on the public side. We just have a lot more stress, a lot more pressure on performance. But having said that, I mean, this is my 42nd year in broadcasting, and I still get out of bed every day loving what I do and realizing that it's a great, great business. It's changing quickly. I just read an article yesterday where the Detroit car makers, anyway, are putting Wi-Fi equivalent opportunities in the dashboards beginning next year. So there'll be even more challenges, more opportunities for people as they're driving down the road. Bill Burton, who's an old and I say old because he's got a good 20 years on you and I.
Because
he's
really
old.
Really
is. But he, he operates the Detroit Radio Advertising Group and has for years. And Bill has always called an automobile is nothing more than a radio on four wheels. But that's really changed, and it's changing quickly. At the same time, research supports that people still have their three or four favorite stations. And whether it's public radio as part of that three or four, or commercial radio, or Sirius, or iHeartRadio or some other form of communications in the car beyond talking to somebody on your phone, it's still that one-to-one, and it's really important more now than ever before to be as localized as you can be. There's too many choices that aren't local. So when you have a chance to be local, and I tell this to our managers all the time, at least here in the state of Michigan where I reign, if you're going to break local. If you're not going to sound like anything but a satellite music service, then we've got a problem.
Gary and Scott, one thing that always has been of interest to me across demographic lines, what does your research tell you both in the private side and the public side about the way this generation is listening to radio and information gathering in general? I mean, what are the differences between, say, those folks that are in college now, maybe in their earlier 20s, versus audiences that are older? And Scott, we'll start with you.
Well, I think what we're seeing, I know what we're seeing, is radio's not going away. It's being used differently than it was. But we still talk to roughly 93% of all Americans every week. That's a big number. I mean, television doesn't get 93%. They may not be listening for the length of time that they used to because their lives are different now. And there are more interruptions, whether you're in the car, at home, at work, or at school. But the fact of the matter is we're still the first choice for new music. And that's a good thing, because there was a while where some artists, I think, thought otherwise and then realized they had to come back to radio. Radio still plays a very important role. And I think what you'll see in the next 5 to 10 years, and I think Gary will probably support this concept, the social media, the advent of all the social media options, terrestrial radio, in fact, radio that's delivered by towers, may in fact be a support service of our social media or digital plan. So a big part of where we're going on the commercial side anyway is the development of all the other digital properties that in fact take advantage of our terrestrial property now, where we can talk about those properties 24/7, get people involved in using our radio stations in a different way than maybe they had before, and evolving as a kind of a one-stop shop, whether it's you're into the terrestrial side of the business or the digital side of the business.
Gary Reed.
Well, in large measure, young college students don't listen to radio. You know, I go into a class, and I haven't taught in a couple of years, but I'll go into class, I'll say, how many have radios? How many listen to radio? Maybe 2 or 3 out of 25 will do that. Scott's point about Bill Burton and the radio with four wheels, you know, when I ask the question a different way, do you have a car? Yes. What do you listen to in the car? Oh, I listen to radio. So the depth that is Scott is really talking about there, I think, is really the important one, and that is that radio is no longer the big medium. Someone's iPhone is, someone's Twitter feed, someone's social media connections is the hot button thing. And so when I talk about coming back to content, that's how it gets delivered. We don't really care, to be blunt about it. We just care that it gets delivered, and we'll figure out a way to do it. So as a broadcast industry, and across the world, Kirk, you travel a lot, we realize that cell phone manufacturers can just enable a chip that is in most everybody's smartphone right now, and we can get radio on our smartphones. And so that just provides another outlet for the content that we're already doing. So with that in mind, I'm very bullish on it, because as Scott, I think, started out, it's not going away. Because it's not AM, it's not FM, it's the personality, it's the information that they come up with. So a young person consumes it differently than some of us, older folks do.
Well, I think a lot is connectivity, too. I threw out a number to someone the other day, and this is the first and last time I'll say the word Ann Arbor in this room, so I apologize.
They get us there. Welcome.
But we do have some radio stations in our company that are in Ann Arbor, and one of them is a big voice of the University of Michigan and that other school. And the what we found with our web hits around the country, we at any given time are talking to 47 different countries around the world on our streaming. So as people graduate and leave that area and find their way to, Cyprus, if they still have a bank account, will in fact listen to their favorite radio station, which is the one that's everything U of M, and they'll do it online. So, I mean, to Gary's point, we're not just in the AM-FM business anymore. We're still in the information business and the entertainment business first and foremost, but I think people still long for that connectivity to something that they can feel and touch and smell, and it brings them home, whatever home is to them. And that's really key. I think that's really what's going to be our savior in terms of not getting lost in everything out there, kind of like the newspapers have, where they got into it a little late, and boy, they're scrambling now. And I'm not sure they're ever going to get it back.
Is hyper-local then the thing, radio stations, particularly, I guess we're talking AM, and maybe specifically sports talk, is there, what about that?
Well, I agree with Scott's point in terms of the digital coverage. But let's face it, no one who's living in East Lansing or Williamston, where I happen to live, no one thinks of themselves as, oh, I'm a local yokel, Everybody thinks of themselves as a world traveler. In many cases, people are. Virtually every student at MSU is going to study overseas. And so the way I view it is we have a finite amount of time in our lives every day. And so our decision is, how are we going to spend that time? And I want to spend the time with something that's happening down the street. I want to spend the time with somebody that I'm familiar with, somebody that I might run into in the grocery store, someone that talks about my sports team, you know, that I'm connected to. And so I'm really in a time management issue. If we can provide that content that helps people connect locally, that's great. To be blunt about it, and coming back to Scott's point earlier, I love to listen to Virgin Radio from London. I listen online. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't spend time with my own stations, but I love their accents, and I love their humor.
More variety.
I listen to Live Ireland when I'm working in my office in the Fisher Building.
So what it comes back to is we're really establishing a personal relationship with the people who listen to us in one way or another, and that's what we've got to get a key on. And I do have to say, picking up on the newspaper thing, and I don't want to jump on the newspapers, but when you think about newspapers, you really know the commentators in some of the big papers. You know the publishers, and with that, what we have to sell is personality. We have to sell that this is a unique show with all the there's 14,000 broadcast stations, radio stations in the country. This is the only one that's got Scott Meyer on it today.
That's right. Well, that's right.
You know, Scott and Gary, given all that you just said about the future of radio, very interesting conversation. But it does seem like the public appetite for sports broadcasting, sports programming, keeps accelerating. Is there going to be a point when we're saturated with sports shows? I mean, I love sports shows. I listen four or five favorite stations, as you guys mentioned. But where's sports broadcasting going?
You know, there's more and more sports stations in markets. Detroit now has three. And that's not a large market. Detroit really is now market number 14. But I think people tire, I think, of the verbal back and forth that you get in politics. I think people get tired of certain kinds of music. I think certainly men get tired of not having anything to talk to when they get invited to a dinner party. So the first thing they gravitate towards, a lot of men do anyway, are sports because it's easy. And when you listen to all sports radio or you get involved in sports radio or even sports television to some point, but really sports radio because you gotta entertain without the visual, you're not debating about the future of the country per se. You're not debating about life or death situations per se. You're really talking about sports, and everybody sees it differently. You know, the slow clock at State is seen one way by State fans, and the slow clock was seen by another way
quite differently
by
Ann Arbor.
The other fans. Yeah, right.
That's right.
And they got to get over it. Maybe they never will, but that's too bad. But at the end of the day, everybody sees it a little differently. You know, it's like we traveled a while ago. My wife and I went down to Charleston, South Carolina, and saw a book in a store, the War of Northern Aggression. Well, that's their view of how the Civil War went. I mean, it was, you know, they don't even call it the Civil War. So sports allows for that kind of commentary, that kind of discussion. And when we first built FAN in New York, one of the things that we tried to do initially was two guys at a bar with a third guy standing behind being part of the conversation. So when you had shows, most of them had two hosts. The hosts would talk back and forth that way, but then allow that third person, whether it's by phone or just as a listener, to be involved and to always keep that in mind, that's what you're doing. You don't want to lose them. You want them invested in what you're talking about.
There are two things that I know about sports broadcasting, and I don't know a lot about sports. First off, sports is the one area where immediacy counts. Everything else that we're doing is can be easily prepackaged. You know, we talk about voice tracking or, you know, satellite dialing. But sports is immediate. It's happening. It starts at a particular time. It ends at a time. And so there's immediacy. And that's one thing that broadcasting does better than anything else, way better than newspapers, you know, et cetera. So we've got immediacy going. The other thing is that everybody's got an opinion. Whether it's right or wrong, as Scott indicates, they've got an opinion. And so when you live in a complicated world, and feel that things aren't going your way, what a better place to vent. And if our sports broadcasting stations, Scott's, our little show here, whatever it would be, if we can provide an audience the ability to do that, then I think it's great. You mentioned some of the technology, HD radio, which is the digitization of standard broadcast. I think that HD radio and web streaming, like Scott indicated a little bit earlier, they have great value added to the immediacy component. Mm. So in the case of HD radio, if you really look at a fully implemented HD radio station, not only do you hear the music, but you've got the data there, and you can even see a little thumbnail of the album cover. That's value added. Mm. There are some cool implementations of sales and marketing. If I'm listening to an HD radio and they run a McDonald's commercial, and I can look down on my dashboard and say, hey, you know, there's a coupon here that I can use, I can go right over and get a free fry, then that becomes a good deal. So the implementation that the digital world allows us to do, picking up on that level of immediacy, is something that I think is great. We haven't, as a broadcast industry, done a very good job marketing where we're at. There are other options, but what I'm saying is that none of this was easy. Scott had a very personal story about not having the money to come up with. This is difficult stuff. I mean, if it were easy, everybody would do it. You know, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be having these discussions. So, new technology takes quite a while to adapt. I mean, FM radio, that is our standard now, was really considered to be kind of a fluffy add-on for years and years. So,
interesting.
From my standpoint, while we live in a go-go world, by the same token, you got to step back and have a little patience to see how this is all going to flesh out.
You know, it's interesting, and to Gary's point, there's, whether it's public or even in the commercial side, the marketplace determines and decides where all these things are going to go. And up until, two or three years ago, when television was forced to turn digital or complete their digital transition, very expensive. It cost a lot of broadcasters a lot of money, but it was something they had to do. But what it's done going forward is broadcast television was in trouble. Cable television was hurting them now. The internet was really hurting them. But now that they've got two or three additional channels, side channels, whether it's public or commercial television, what they're finding are people are rebelling and saying, I'm not paying $200 a month for cable anymore. I can easily get internet access. I can watch the few favorite shows that I have, and maybe I can even download them for very little cost or no cost. And, oh, by the way, if I only have access on an antenna, now I can get 20 or 30 stations where I could only get four. And you have all these choices. Now, granted, it may not be prime time TV other than the basic ABC, CBS, or Fox. But at the end of the day, the side stuff that's out there, my wife and I are big fans of watching Create, which is a network built just for the digital side of public television. Mm. It for us replaces our cable version of HGTV, but we can get it by using an antenna and don't have to be hooked up to the cable. So for radio, digital was a little too early. HD was a little too early. It caught everybody right at the time when everybody was, you know, moving all these stations around. Nobody wanted to put the money into it. It was the beta, if you will, of the argument between beta and VHS. The people that were building radios weren't getting on the bandwagon. There was discussion between two different HD delivery systems, and no one could determine where they were going to go. Well, they went nowhere. So even though I have HD channels available and most of the stations that I have responsibility for, our listenership you can count on one hand. I mean, it's very limited. Then these came along, these being smartphones. And I agree, you drive through any campus and you're going to see every kid in America has one in their hand. I mean, they don't have gloves on. They've got one of these in their hand. But it delivers everything, including my radio stations, including literally every between Twitter or Facebook or however their social networking, whether they're just texting. I'm sure all of you have tried to call your children and realize that they'll exempt your phone call. They might take your text, maybe, and then maybe call you back. But because that is kind of passe, I think HD radio may evolve at some point if there's some way that it works within the confines of the digital platform. But I really think streaming now has carried forward a lot of the terrestrial product that we deliver. And has just, that part of our business has really kind of gone by the by. It's unfortunate. We all spent some money on developing it, and there it's kind of a white elephant.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That's Scott Meyer, Midwest Regional Vice President for Cumulus Media, talking about the state and future of radio. In that conversation, you also heard from MSU's Director of Public Broadcasting, Gary Reed, and my co-host, Dr. Kirk Heinze. I'm Russ White.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Whether you're moving across town or across the country, relocating to a new job or a new city is always a challenge. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, wherever you go, you'll have an instant circle of friends on hand to help you get settled and get connected. With more than 100 clubs and affiliates around the world, there's a Spartan in just about every city. And as an MSU Alumni Association member, you'll quickly feel right at home. Wherever you go, community, connections, careers, and class, four great reasons to visit alumni.msu.edu today to activate your membership in the largest Spartan organization in the world. That's alumni.msu.edu, the Michigan State University Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
MSU Ag Bio Research is changing the face of science.
People should know that Ag Bio Research is really the first front at MSU dealing with environmental issues and natural resources issues.
Dr. Steve Papke leads MSU Ag Bio Research. More than 300 scientists from six MSU colleges are leading innovation in food, natural resources, and energy.
MSU Ag Bio Research really is changing the face of science. If we can do that right, we create economic opportunities here in Michigan and opportunities for our researchers to make some really interesting discoveries.
Our goal is to generate economic prosperity, sustain natural resources, and enhance the quality of life for all.
We're MSU Ag Bio Research.
Visit agbioresearch.msu.edu. MSU Ag Bio Research is changing the face of science.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, for folks who might be just tuning in studio with us is Jim Robinson, who's the Executive Vice President of Farm Bureau Insurance of Michigan. Farm Bureau Insurance does so much in terms of supporting athletics, so with scholarships, the state basketball tournament, so many other things. Why does Farm Bureau put so many resources into behind athletics, Jim?
Well, I think, Kirk, you probably know we're a Michigan-based company, and we only sell in the state of Michigan. So we have over 450 agents in nearly every community throughout this state. And as a result, we want to give back, and we want to give back to this state. We've been here for nearly 64 years in this state, and that's all we know. So in terms of that, it's important for us to give back. And one of the ways that we can give back, particularly, is through a variety of different programs and sponsorships. And you mentioned our Michigan High School Athletic Association. We give away 32 $1,000 scholarships each year, and we will be handing out those scholarships to what I like to call they are absolutely student athletes. And I think it's so important that we don't separate those two, because and when you look at the resumes of these student athletes, it's amazing. Not only are they good on the athletic field or the court, but they're great in the classroom, and many, many of them are so heavily involved in their community and other aspects of life that they're so well-rounded. And those are the kinds of people that we want to be associated with, that we hope will stay in Michigan and help build this great state to even a better place to live in into the future. So, and in a small way, for the last 24 years and the scholarships that we've given. Up to this point in time, we've given over $608,000 in scholarships to youngsters, high school seniors, and we feel very proud of that. I think that speaks highly of the kids that we have coming up through our school systems throughout the state of Michigan, and we hope that we can keep some of them here in the state of Michigan to become future leaders, maybe not on an athletic field, but within an organization or in a community, and that they give back as well.
Jim, in addition to all the great stuff you do with the Michigan High School Athletic Association, you folks are also heavily into sponsorship of minor league baseball. I think you see it as a family venue. It's something that people can afford. It's in their communities. It speaks to Farm Bureau's mission about a Michigan-based company.
Yes, we do, Kirk. We've been involved here in Lansing with Lansing Lugnuts since they started. I think we're probably going to be entering, I believe, the 17th season of the Lugnuts here in Lansing, and they've become a fixture in our community. We have also been involved with the Midland Loons since they began here, and then also we've been involved over in Grand Rapids with the Whitecaps and up in Traverse City with a little known unknown team, probably the Beach Bums. But it's great family entertainment, and some of the values that those organizations have and hold near to their heart, we do in our organization as well.
That's Farm Bureau Insurance's Jim Robinson. I'm Russ White with Kirk Heinze, and we do a show together called Greening of the Great Lakes that's focused on sustainability broadly. Jim, which kind of leads to my next question. I'm wondering about the issues that just the insurance industry is grappling with, and I thought I read recently where it's even the insurance industry that's trying to cut through some of the PR that's going against saying there's some climate change, because uncertainty is not good for insurance companies, and that seems to be something that climate change could be causing, is uncertainty. Look at the differences in the two marches we've just had the last 2 years. I'm not sure what my question is, but sort of how are you dealing with that?
Well, you know, in our industry, weather is as important to us in insurance as it is to our parent organization in agriculture. And last year, your example is a great one. In March, we had 4 days in a row where we had 80 degrees. And while we all enjoyed those 4 days, the fruit farmers, particularly the apple and cherry farmers of the state, it was devastating. The trees budded, and then we had frost and freeze again after that, and we essentially lost the entire crop. So that's, you know, more from an agricultural perspective. From an insurance perspective, you know, as storms come through, you know, that's obviously, we don't have the issue of hurricanes and tsunamis and some of the storms that we've seen, Sandy last year in particular, but we certainly in Michigan, we're entering tornado season. You know, so they're straight line winds. We just came through a fairly mild winter by all perspectives, you know, but ice storms, snow storms, black ice, all those things create fires, accidents, losses in the insurance industry. And there's a number of models that we rely on to determine what our losses are. But we are fortunate in a sense that we're protected by the Great Lakes. So in Michigan, our exposure to certain types of risks that are in other parts of the country aren't as great. Though we had a drought last summer, and with fire, you know, those were some concerns, but it didn't bear out as much, and actually was a pretty good year for us from a storm perspective.
When you look at these models, Jim, I mean, you're not too different from a lot of other businesses, but you're looking at the models that are based on good, solid scientific research, and a lot of that comes out of our state land-grant university.
Yes, it does, through Michigan State University, and we have a long time standing relationship, our organization, and in many aspects of this university, and it's a great resource for us and the business community here in Lansing area.
Of course, one of the gems is that people don't know the state climatologist for Michigan is geography prof Jeff Andreessen, whom we talk to quite
a bit. And he has a regular column in the Farm News every time it comes out from Michigan Farm Bureau.
Yes, Jim, he does.
Jim Robinson, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That's Jim Robinson, Executive Vice President for Farm Bureau Insurance, Michigan's insurance company.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from The Spartan Life. The key, says Stephen Covey, is not in spending time, but investing it. You are a person of value. Your quality time is limited, so it's essential that you invest most of it in people who appreciate and reciprocate. Keith Ferrazzi tells us that the only true way to get a return on a relationship investment is to give without the expectation of return. That's great advice, but it's also true that your own soul must have nourishment if it is to have the strength to make a difference in the world. So make sure your portfolio of friends has more than a few reciprocators in it. Our lives are filled with transactional relationships. We pay for something, they provide it, and that's the end of the transaction. People mumble, "Thanks for your business," and "Have a great day" after we've handed over the cash and they hand over the hamburgers, but they don't really mean it. That's not reciprocation. The places we return to, time and again, are populated with authentic souls who genuinely are interested in us, who are proactive in their interactions, who make us feel like what we do for them really means something, who reflect back the positive energy we try to share, even on the rare occasions when our own energy level is low. This is reciprocation. Reciprocation does not always mean appreciation. The best feedback is honest feedback. Sometimes that hurts. But if it comes from a place of affection, you will ultimately be glad you got it. One of my all-time most popular Monday motivators talks about the importance of de-emphasizing unfulfilling relationships and prioritizing people who care. This is a key to personal growth and chasing happiness. Treat everyone as you want to be treated, but over the long haul, don't invest in people who don't appreciate it. It's okay to give without expecting a return, but not all the time. Long-term relationships don't work if you're the only one who is doing the heavy lifting. People who don't reciprocate aren't necessarily bad people. They may have something going on inside that you don't know about. They may have other priorities, or they might just not be that into you. That's okay. If it feels like a temporary thing, hang in there. If it's a pattern, let them go. You will get some time back to spend on someone else who appreciates you. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.